I really appreciate the fact, please be seated. I really appreciate the fact that I tend to say that during the year of the Eucharist, during a 3-year Eucharistic revival, during this middle period of the Eucharistic revival, that we're able to have these periods of adoration in the middle of our morning's reflection. And everything that we were just talking about this morning, about the Eucharist being the center of unity, I think what better way than to be here with the Lord, the one who not only created us, who made us, but the Lord who gathers us together around himself, him as the center from which our unity really derives. What I'd like to focus on right now, again, we're kind of following the logic of John Paul II, who went back to the basics in writing this document on the Eucharist as the center of the Church. This morning's reflection, or this morning's meditation, rather, is going to be from something that we hear all the time. I'm just going to take kind of the words of consecration from the Mass. I'm going to use the second Eucharistic prayer and simply lead us in a reflection, a meditation, using these words. And then give us, obviously, some time of personal reflection. Hopefully I'll try to give us a bit of time just for our own personal prayer with the Lord. In the second Eucharistic prayer, it says, "At the time he was betrayed and entered willingly into his passion, he took bread, and giving thanks, broke it and gave it to his disciples." So what was the context? The context was that we are in a Passover liturgy. The Passover is the holiest moment in the Jewish liturgical year. It is the commemoration of Moses is freeing the people from Egypt after the plagues that Moses had called down upon the people of Egypt, culminating in the death of the firstborn, when God had told Moses, "Take a lamb, sacrifice it, and use the blood of the lamb to mark the lintels of your doorposts of your homes, so that the destroying angel will not come and affect your homes." Every home that doesn't have the sign of the blood of the lamb, every firstborn in that home will be destroyed. And the lamb was to be eaten that night, roasted and eaten that night, consumed. Already we see a strong Eucharistic symbolism there. The blood of the lamb is the protection of the people of God. And God wants us to consume the lamb. And if we don't consume the lamb, we will not enter into the covenant that God, the union with God that he is offering to his people. And then in the Passover, we know Moses leads the people out into the desert, eventually across the Red Sea, which symbolizes baptism. The idea that the Red Sea, when you enter into the waters, you're in a certain sense entering into death and then coming out the other side, entering into a new life. That was kind of the symbolism of baptism in the Red Sea. So whenever we're baptized, St. Paul says we're baptized into his death, and we come back. Remember, it used to be a plunging, used to be immersion, generally speaking, and into a new life. The old man is dead, and the new life of God's grace within us, the indwelling of the Holy Trinity in our hearts, which enlivens our souls with sanctifying grace, which then nourishes our intellects, wills, and memories through faith, hope, and love, and enables us to act in a God-like way because we have God's life living in us. That's what's happening there. And this is the context for the Last Supper. And it says, "He took bread and he broke it." We know that he's about to say that this is my body, and he's already breaking it. He's saying, my body is about to be broken for you. And giving thanks, broke it and gave it to his disciples, saying, take this, all of you, and eat of it, for this is my body, which will be given up for you. Earlier in John chapter 6, Christ had challenged the people by the Sea of Galilee. He said, unless you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, you have no life in you. And he challenged them a couple of different times. Every time they came back to him, said, you can't possibly mean this. And he said, yes, actually I do. And most of his disciples left him. And he was left pretty much from the sounds of things with the 12. And he challenged them too. He says, will you too leave me? And there's a reason why, I mean, aside from just the fact that naturally this sounds disgusting, there's a reason why it would have shocked the Jewish people. Well, we'll get to that in a little bit, because that would be more in the second consecration prayer. But the words he uses, again, the Gospels were written in Greek, so we, to go to the quote-unquote original, we would have to go to the Greek. He says, this is my body. Now, Greek had two words for body. There's sarx, S-A-R-X, and soma. Sarx is kind of more like, you know, this is my body with meat, like, you know, material body. Soma would imply kind of this is my, like, more like your person, okay? So when he uses the word soma, I believe, maybe I'm mixing the two up, I forget which is which actually, but whichever one he uses, the word he's using is implying not just simply, he's not just taking a piece of bread and saying, this isn't just bread, this is actually, you know, human flesh. He's saying, this is me. This is my person, which is given up, which will be given up for you. I'm sure the disciples are wondering, well, partially there may be a flashback to John chapter 6, because when Jesus challenged the disciples, he says, will you also leave me? And St. Peter gives those beautiful words, Lord, to whom will we go? You alone have the words of everlasting life. Not all of them believed. That's actually the first moment that we hear that one of his disciples didn't believe. He says, John goes on to comment, he says, blessed are you, Peter. I forget the words, but he praises Peter, and he says, for he knew those who believed in him, and he knew he who was about who would betray him. It's the first time in the Gospels ever mention of who would betray him ever came up in John chapter 6. So maybe the disciples were kind of grateful when this whole thing of unless you eat my flesh and drink my blood came up, and they say, oh, okay, well, this is a form that I can accept it in. This is that's not cannibalism. I can do that. And nonetheless, we know that it's at the Last Supper that Judas abandoned him definitively. He already had his plan in mind, but it says in the moment when Christ, we don't know if it's before or after, presumably after the Eucharist, when Christ gave Judas the morsel, it says he took it, and at that moment Satan entered into him, and he departed, and it was night. Okay? So the Eucharist has, from the very beginning, been a stone upon which we stumble, kind of a sign of contradiction, something that demands of us radical faith. We can't be indifferent about it. A lot of us are. To be indifferent about the Eucharist it's ultimately to be indifferent about God. And there isn't literally, there's not really any such thing as indifference about God. You're either for him or you're for yourself selfishly. Those are the two options in life. You can be a nice person, but so kind of selfish. Like, I don't want to offend anybody, but when push comes to shove, if I really have to make a hard choice, it's about me. Or you can be about God. Am I willing to give my life for my neighbor? Am I willing to give my life if God asks it of me? Is he the most important value in my life or not? In a similar way, when supper was ended, he took the chalice, and once more giving thanks, he gave it to his disciples, saying, take this, all of you, and drink from it, For this is the chalice of my blood, the blood of the new and eternal covenant, which will be poured out for you and for many for the forgiveness of sins. Do this in memory of me. This particular prayer, I mean, they both have equal power in the sense of they both consecrate species into the body and blood of Christ, but the symbolism of these words is tremendously powerful. This is the chalice of my blood. Now, when I said earlier the bit about the disciples being scandalized, you know, how can he give us his flesh to eat? Well, Jewish law had a rule that you do not drink the blood of animals. You do not eat flesh that has the lifeblood in it. And the reason was simple. The idea of spirit in the Jewish language, ruah, is the same word for wind. And the idea is, like, the spirit is something you breathe in and you breathe out. When you're dead, you stop breathing, you don't have your spirit in you, okay? And there's actually some truth to that, because when we breathe, where does the oxygen go? Through our lungs, into our blood. They picked up on that. If a person suffocates, they turn blue. They don't have any more oxygen in them. They kind of, in their own primitive way, got that. Well, if you consider that air and spirit are all kind of the same, what happens if you are drinking blood of animals or eating meat that has blood in it? You're communing with their spirit, which was a practice in pagan religions. It was a means by which they would either A, you know, drink the blood of the bull or ox in order to try to gain the strength of the ox, or B, enter into demonic worship, which the ancient religions in Palestine in the time of before the Hebrews came and kind of cleaned them out. Like, whenever we read about all these other religions and Baal and why are the Israelites so mean and they put them to the sword and kill them and everything, it's because they're worshiping devils and sacrificing their children to them in living flames. When there's a culture that is irrepentant in offering up human sacrifice, and you are, and nonetheless, there's the temptation that they will corrupt you because they tend to be wealthier, and you're thinking, well, they must be doing something right. Maybe we should do what they're doing. So God is saying, have nothing to do with that. Okay. The Jewish people are hearing this. Jesus is saying, drink my blood. It's the same logic of entering into those demonic rituals, you know, whereby you enter into communion with a demon or something like that. And Jesus is saying, do that with me. The only way that that is valid and licit is if Jesus is God. If he's God, then it's not only valid, but it's beautiful. God himself is saying, enter into communion with me through my blood. And it goes further here in the prayer of consecration. This is the blood of the new and eternal covenant. Now, covenant is a kind of a contract. It's more than a contract, but it is a legal contract whereby either two people, individuals, or two families, or two nations, or parties of whatever sort, enter into, under the grace of God, so you call upon divine blessings, and there are also divine curses involved in it. If you don't live up to it, if you live up to it, God will give these blessings. If you don't, these are the curses. There's always that factor. Whereby you become family. Marriage is the primordial, and it is still the covenant that any of us understand. When two people get married sacramentally, you are entering into a covenant. You're calling upon God to unite you, and two people. I did not just say that. Two people become one. The two become one flesh. Sarx, I think it is actually. The two become one person, so to speak. Are they still obviously free and independent and get in fights and everything unless they make the effort to understand each other and love each other and all that? Of course, you know that far better than I do. But where there is authentic love, and especially when there's authentic marriage blessed and bonded by a sacrament, in a very real way, the two people, you too become one with your spouse. And you know, your life, if you're living your marriage well, is not about what I want or what I should do. It's about us. It's about what we should be doing, what is best for our family. It stops being about me, 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 and it starts being about it's inconceivable me doing something, you know, irrespective of what my spouse thinks. And this is the new and eternal covenant, the covenant that God had promised for centuries through the prophets. We know that from the very beginning, from the Garden of Eden, there were already covenants, and then Noah, there was a covenant, and Abraham, one of the most famous covenants, when he promised, I will make you a father of nations, even though it seemed like I don't have any children, and how is this going to happen? And so all of the Old Testament is a history of covenants, and God would be faithful, and we would wreck it, and God would be faithful again, and we would break it, and then he would come and offer an even better covenant, and then the great one was the Mosaic covenant. Which where the law and the Ten Commandments and everything came, and Mount Sinai, and we became, or the Jewish people became the people of God, so to speak. But we kept messing up. And God, through the prophets, was promising there will come a day when there's going to be a new covenant. It's going to be, have certain characteristics. It will be everlasting, never to be broken. It will be universal, so not only for the Jewish people, but for the whole world. That was one that they always seem to have a hard time getting their arms around. It's like, no, this is ours. You guys stay away. You're Gentiles. And it would be written in our hearts. It would no longer be in tablets of stone. It would be written in the human heart. And we would have no need of going around teaching each other, in a sense, the law of God, because it will dwell within us. These are the promises that the prophets in different moments throughout the books made of the new covenant. And in this moment, Jesus is saying, this is the blood of the new covenant. For there to be a covenant, there also needed to be shedding of blood. There was always a sacrifice of some form. And Jesus is saying, this is the sacrifice. This is the blood that's bringing about the covenant you have always wanted. Perfect communion with God, everlasting, that's open to all people, that will be written in human hearts. It will be poured out for you and for many. The word many can be, Pope Benedict spoke a lot about this in one of his books. You know, sometimes we say, you many, you and for all, you and for many. What's the proper translation? Well, the literal translation is you and for many. The meaning, though, basically means simultaneously. It's not everybody in the sense that everyone's going to accept it. A lot of people say no, and a lot of people, unfortunately, go to hell. Truth. But the offer is there, and the redemption that Christ works is for all of history, all of humanity. From the beginning of time until the end, God's grace is available. And that's why there is redemption for people who don't even believe in Jesus, as long as they, you know, do the best they can and whatnot. He's not unjust. And there is the possibility of redemption for everybody. Do this in memory of me. Again, when he's saying do this in memory of me, it's not just saying do this and remember me when you do it. He's saying do it as a memorial. A memorial was a liturgical word for the Jewish people. When the Jews celebrate Passover today, it's a memorial, just like our Mass is a memorial. When the Jews celebrate Passover, you and I are not allowed, and it's not because they're mean. They shouldn't allow us to take part because we're not Jews. We're not part of that covenant. We can't. And when they celebrate the Passover, at least when they do it properly, they're entering into, in a certain sense, it's like a time machine where they go back in time and space to the Red Sea, to Sinai, to the original Passover, and they enter into that liturgically. And they receive God's grace and blessing through that Passover liturgy. The same thing is happening in the Mass. Jesus is saying this is a memorial to be repeated. And when we repeat the Eucharistic sacrifice, when we know, we say Jesus is being, we're entering into Jesus' crucifixion, death, and resurrection, it's not like he's doing it millions and billions of times over. It means that millions and billions of times over, we're entering the time machine and going back to the one sacrifice. And we're drawing from that over and over again. And he's making himself present to us constantly. And that's what a memorial is. The Mass is the memorial par excellence. And Jesus is saying, do this as memorial of me. And he's doing all of this because, he says, I have made you because I wanted, in the beginning, the entire purpose for your existence. You know, I didn't need to make any of you. God was perfectly happy in heaven when he was all by his lonesome. There were no angels, there were no saints, there was nothing. God is perfectly, absolutely happy. He needed nothing. But he decided once upon a time, wouldn't it be great if there was somebody to share this happiness with? And I didn't just in a certain sense, selfishly, even though he's never selfish because there's a Trinity, there's always three persons, but wouldn't it be great to have something and someone to share this with? So he chose to create us. And the only reason he created us was so that we could enter into communion with him and enjoy that happiness. And this is the gateway. And right now we have, how much time do we have? About 25 minutes. Is that right?
No.
What time? What time should we be finishing? 12:30?
12.
Oh, we have 15 minutes. We're not finishing at 12. We have 15 minutes then to spend with the Lord who offers himself this way. Father, Son, Holy Spirit.